Good morning. This is kind of a dark way to begin a sermon, but bear with me. Imagine that you knew ahead of time, years in advance, that one day you were going to be murdered. Imagine that you not only knew when, you knew where, you knew why, you knew how, and you knew the who. You knew who was going to murder you. Imagine that you knew that your closest friends were going to abandon you in that moment in your most dire hour of need. Imagine that you knew that the powerful, knowledgeable, articulate leaders around you were not only going to fail to save you, they were going to be some of the ones who made sure that you were murdered. Imagine that you knew that your death, your murder, was not going to be quick, it's not going to be painless. You're going to die slowly. You're going to die in great agony and pain in one of the most brutal types of executions known to man. Imagine that you knew that some of your friends and your family would be there at the last minute, including your mom. She'd be there. But your worst enemies were also going to be there too, looking up at you with vicious grins on their faces, enjoying watching the life ebb out of your body every minute that it happened. You understand where I'm going with all this by now. But I want to ask you to think about what you would do if you knew that that kind of murder was ahead of you in your life. If you were burdened with that knowledge years in advance, what would that do to your mental health? Can you even imagine? Waking up in the morning, going about your day, and there's that thought right there. Every single day, you know what's coming. And every step that you take gets you one step closer to your abhorrent, brutal end. Would you curl up in a fetal position in a corner somewhere? Would you become a recluse and get away from people as much as you possibly could? Or would you do what we read about Jesus doing in his ministry work, of going out into the world and rubbing elbows with as many people as he possibly could, doing all of the healing and all of the teaching that we see him doing? It's interesting, in chapter 4, right before the Sermon on the Mount, we read about him healing every disease and every affliction of the people who came to him. Then he teaches this sermon on the Mount, out right off of the Sea of Galilee, and he says things like, you've got to love your enemies, and you've got to pray for those who persecute you, and you are blessed, and you are a son of your Father if you participate in what the prophets did before you. But starting from chapter 8 on through the rest of the Gospel of Matthew until the crucifixion, we see him making conscious choices to live out what he's already preached about what the kingdom is and what it means. We're going to see his actions in daily life reflecting the powerful words that he's already preached. If this is the kind of Lord that we have, who takes illnesses that do not belong to him onto himself and takes personal responsibility for sins that don't belong to him, then he can and he should be believed in. and he should be sacrificed for with everything that we've got. If we truly believe in the power of Jesus' words to heal, we will give up everything to follow him. That is the core of this chapter. And in 18 through 22, which we're not going to talk about until the end of the sermon, I want you to see how that sits pretty well smack dab in the middle of this vast discussion of all of these different power-packed stories about him doing this. This is the kind of Lord that we have. And this is the kind of person that he wants to turn us into as well. So let's go through these stories, and I want to notice what they're about, and then I want to go back through them again, and I want to notice a thread that runs through them, and then we'll look at the follow me passage. So let's just walk through this. 1 through 4, what we see Jesus doing is touching a leper to make him clean. Our word leprosy today, which is talking about Hansen's disease, that's a very specific type of disease, as I understand it. But this word leprosy in our Bible is just a kind of an umbrella term to talk about a lot of different kinds of skin diseases. But all of them, no matter which one that you had, serious or not serious, all of them fit under what Leviticus 13 talks about. They all make you unclean. And if you were unclean, you were commanded by God to look like a hobo. You were commanded by God to let the hair of your head be loose, to kind of hang off of your body. You were commanded to wear clothing that was torn. You were commanded, when you were around other people, to cover your mouth, to cover the upper part of your lip, and to yell out, "Unclean, unclean," so that everybody would understand who you were, and they would keep their distance from you. You had to live alone. You were commanded to live outside the camp. When this man comes up to Jesus, but based on what he says to Jesus, he's got some understanding already prior to this moment about who Jesus is. Otherwise, he wouldn't have said what he says. But he has no guarantees that Jesus is going to look upon him with compassion and actually heal his body. He might be expecting, because no doubt he's experienced this his entire life, of people looking at him and taking 3 steps back. It's not what Jesus does. And not only does Jesus express the willingness to heal, because notice what he says. If you are willing, you can do this. Jesus says, "I am, be clean," and he touches the man's body. He didn't have to heal him that way. This may have been the first human touch that this man had received in a very long time, and it's the touch of his Creator. Ordinarily, uncleanness would bring guilt to you if you touched it. That's Leviticus 5. But in this case, Jesus transfers his holiness to this man, and the man becomes clean. How powerful is this when we think about our own lives? Because sometimes we're interested in helping lepers, but we're interested in doing that 20 feet away. We're interested in helping somebody learn more about Jesus, but maybe we're only willing to do that with a side conversation at the church building. Maybe we're only willing to do that with a text that we lob in that person's direction once in a while. But maybe we're not willing to have that person sit down at our table and eat dinner with us and come into the confines of our personal space in our home because that person's a leper. That person's unclean. Yes. And that's exactly why that person needs to be drawn close and not shoved away. Yes, you get healed, but you stay over there, and I'll stay over here. Sometimes that's our attitude, and this flies in the face of that because Jesus did not stand 20 feet away. He stood 2 feet away with his hands on the man's body and made him whole. That's the first story. Second story is no less remarkable, because even though we don't have a leper in this second story, the man who comes up to Jesus might as well have been a leper, because he's a Roman, or he's at least in league with the Romans, working for the Romans, leading the charge. He's a centurion. And he doesn't come for himself, though. Notice how he comes for somebody else. His servant is suffering. He's got a problem that nobody else can fix. The Greek word in verse 6 for servant was a term of endearment, I've been told by people who know Greek a lot better than I do. It was a term that was often used to refer to slaves who had some kind of connection to their master that went beyond, go fix my breakfast and make my bed and go get the wheat in from the field. It was a term used to talk about servants who had some affection from their master. When this man tells Jesus that he only needs to speak a word and this servant is going to be healed, Jesus says, that is what faith looks like. And I haven't seen much of that faith in my dealings with the Israelites, the Jews. It's pretty rare around these parts. And so he goes on to talk about people like this Roman. Gentiles are going to come from all over, and they're going to sit at the table of God. But Jews who don't believe like this man did were going to be disbarred from the kingdom forever. So that's a stark passage. And then we move on to that immediately to the next story, which is also interesting. In 14 through 17, we find out that Peter has a wife because he has a mother-in-law who is living in his household. Jesus goes to that house. And when it says that she was lying sick with a fever, that literally means having been thrown down with a fever. And so this is not a woman who has an elevated temp of 99.3. We should not think about this story in those kinds of terms. The force of the language suggests that she is really in a bad condition. But Jesus, like the leper in the first part of the chapter, notice what he does. He doesn't just stand there across the room and say, okay, you can get up, you can get better. He goes over and he touches her body and makes her well. And notice what she does. In return, she jumps up and does what she had evidently always wanted to do as Jesus comes into her house, in the house of her son-in-law and daughter. She serves, which is always God's plan for you and me. When Jesus heals us and helps us, he expects us to get up and then be used as vessels to help other people to receive the healing of God. And then later that night, we're told that he heals all kinds of people who come to the door of that house with their demons and their diseases. He heals all of them. And Matthew tells us that that was done in order to fulfill the words of Isaiah 53, which is, in its context, a passage about how he deals with our sins and our transgressions, and he suffers excruciating things so that those can be taken away. What he's doing with bodies is a sign that the greater healing is coming, the healing of souls, the forgiveness of sins. And like I said, we're going to skip the next paragraph, but we're coming back to it. I want to skip to 23 to 27. And I want to notice the language here. Sea of Galilee was and is still to this day kind of an unusual part of God's creation. It is 13 miles long. It is 8 miles wide. It has a maximum depth of 150 feet, and it sits almost 700 feet below sea level. It is surrounded by mountains on most of its sides. And it was often full of boats. One ancient historian actually estimated that on any given day, there were more than 300 fishing vessels on the lake doing their fishing. And so all of them were in constant danger of storms that would sweep down into this natural cauldron and whip up the water into 20-foot waves and wash away all kinds of boats. Even experienced sailors, like the people in this boat that Jesus is in, they could be unexpectedly caught in a dangerous gale. I wonder if these guys had family members or friends or people that they knew in their towns who had died on this lake. That would not have been an unusual occurrence. And now they themselves are in a troubled spot. In fact, verse 24, did you notice how this is the kind of storm that was swamping or covering, some translations say, this boat with the water. So they're panicked. And unbelievably, Jesus is sleeping through all of this. I can't sleep like that. I don't think I ever have been able to do that. But this boat is going all over the place. There's water coming in great amounts. And here he is. It's so ironic because, remember, Jonah fell asleep in a boat because he was fleeing from the work that God wanted him to do. But Jesus is falling asleep on a boat because he's on the way to do more work that God wanted him to do. He's going to the other side and he's going to do a miracle over there as well. And so when they wake him up, Jesus does what Jesus did all the way back in Genesis 1. He looks at the watery chaos and he speaks words and he says, "Let it be ordered." But he doesn't just rebuke the elements. Did you notice that he also rebukes the disciples? Not for their cry of help, but for the fear that was attached to their cry of help, for the lack of faith that it showed. And so, at least in my translation, a great storm turns itself into a great calm because Jesus works on it, to the amazement of the people in the boat. And then in the last part of this, in 28 through 34, you notice when they get to the other side, after all of that has been stilled, they run across two guys. In some of the Gospels, it's one guy. In Matthew, it's two guys who are possessed by demons, and nobody can do anything about this situation. In verse 28, Matthew actually tells us that the way through this area has kind of been shut down because of these two guys are living in this area. And so nobody can approach them or this place, but Jesus does. And you notice the reaction of the demons. They are hostile to Jesus' presence. And they know who he is. And so they start this conversation and they say, "What are you doing here? What do you have to do with us? It is not the time yet, Jesus." So they know where they're headed. They know the judgment ahead of them, and they are objecting to the fact that you seem to be coming early. We know it's not time for judgment. You can't mess with us. But he's the king, and so he comes and says, "It is time for you." Maybe not the final judgment time, but it is time for you to leave these guys' bodies. And so they, recognizing their position, they beg permission to get a new host, to latch onto something else. And so there's a herd of unclean pigs. Let's go into those. And so he grants permission. The demons are immediately destroyed, or the animals are destroyed, and the townspeople beg them to leave. All right, now that we've seen the stories, I want to go back briefly through them again, and I want you to notice a habitual thread that runs through all of these. In the first story that we see with the leper who gets touched by Jesus, it's not just he touched him, he also made this kingly declaration. Do you notice the language of this? It's not, I'm willing to try, which is what you might get when you go to a doctor. If you've got a really serious disease, and you go to one of these physicians around here, you go to Carl, you go to even a specialist in some field, some things are so complicated and so hard to reach and so hard to know exactly what to do, maybe the best response you can get is, I'm going to try. Jesus says, be clean. And he's able at the microscopic level to change what is going on in this person's body. A monumental task, but not for him, because he's the king. And then in verse 8, I love this. When you see the centurion coming to Jesus and he says what he says here, notice how he makes a statement about what he believes Jesus' authority to be like. Now, you remember from back in chapter 7, at the very end of the Sermon on the Mount, do you remember in 7:29, it says that the crowds were astonished at his teaching, for he was teaching them as one who had authority. That same word is used here in the language of the centurion when he says, you know, I too am a man under authority. I know what authority means. And it means you can say something and boom, it happens. And so I understand you only need to say the word and it will be done. In verse 9, I say to one, go, and he goes. And then in verse 13, Jesus says, go. I love that. We're going to keep building on that though. But for right now, notice verse 16. After he heals the mother-in-law and everybody is swamping his door, notice how it says he cast out the spirits, the demons, with a word. A word. You know, when you read fantasy stories, fictional accounts of magicians performing spells, sometimes they have to sweat a lot, and they have to open up their books, and they've got to recite these very long magic spells in order for anything to happen, what they're trying to accomplish. But Jesus is able to make spirits bend to his will by only speaking a word, and it happens without breaking a sweat. And then, of course, we have what he does with the winds and the waves. The language is, he rebuked them. I love that word. That rebuke there means to express strong disapproval of someone or to speak seriously, to warn. So he talks to nature like it's an unruly child. You know, sometimes we sing the song about this scene and the chorus gets really quiet. Peace be still, peace be still. That's not the way that it happened in the story. In the story, he goes, hey, quit it! and it does! Yeah, stop that! and so, in verse 25, when they wake him up, and they say, we're dying, we're perishing, I don't think they were expecting him to do what he does here. But because in verse 27, they're asking themselves, how is it that nature responds to his voice? Yeah, I understand, you know, we're on land and we're healing people, we're doing things like that, but this is on a completely different level. But then they get to the other side, and I want you to notice this. If you're using a translation that has words of Christ in red, you're going to notice a solid paragraph of black words except for one single red word, and I want you to link it up with verse 16 in the text. Remember how it said, he cast out the spirits with a word. When you notice verse 32, how many words does he use to cast out the spirits in these two guys? Isn't that great? That's so cool. We know from the other Gospels that these demons were named Legion, for they were many. So you have potentially thousands of demons in these two guys' bodies. Formidable strength, but all Jesus does is say, go. And they go. And they leave. With his permission to go into other creatures. It's the same word that he uses in verse 13 when he tells the centurion to go, let it be done as you have believed. That's the kind of power in this person who is going from town to town and village to village and crossing this unruly lake and doing anything he wants to do with the spirits and the winds and the bodies of broken people in front of him. I want you to be struck by the authority of Jesus Christ today. And I want you to be struck by that because all of that gives a context for the middle part of this chapter. I told you we would be coming back to the paragraph that I skipped. We're doing that now. I want to read this again. Danny did a fine job, but I want to read 18 through 22 again. Now when Jesus saw a crowd around him, he gave orders to go to the other side. And a scribe came up and said to him, "Teacher, I will follow you wherever you go." And Jesus said to him, "Foxes have holes, birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head." Another of the disciples said to him, "Lord, let me first go and bury my father." And Jesus said to him, "Follow me and leave the dead to bury their own dead." So he's approached by two men who are interested in following him. And no doubt, many of the people who read this gospel for the first time were also disciples, were also interested in following him as well, and had signed up for his cause. And he tells them, as he tells us, that in order to follow through with that good desire, it requires a commitment to sacrifice everything. If the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head, what does that mean for disciples? Now, this does not mean that Jesus was homeless. Like back in chapter 4, in verse 13, we're told that he had a set place to live in Capernaum. Capernaum was his home. Whether the home belonged to him or somebody else, he had a roof over his head whenever he came to Galilee. So he's not saying, "I'm just always homeless." He wasn't a vagabond, but this is probably a way of talking about, if you follow me, it's going to mean exposure. It's going to mean discomfort on all kinds of levels. It's going to mean you feel vulnerable because you're living in this world that is ruled by the evil one, and he's not going to appreciate you going out there and trying to set people free from their sins with the gospel message. So you got to have a sacrificial mindset that comes from a true belief. And his words, as he says in the next statement to this other guy, his words have to so dominate our lives, our souls, our thinking, that it takes over our calendar. It takes over what we want to do with our lives. And it even trumps the most important family connections and obligations of our lives. It is stark that he says, "Leave the dead to bury their own dead." There are different ways of interpreting that statement, but all of them circle back around to, "I come over everyone and everything." Why would we want to follow a Lord so completely? It's because he has the power to take our illnesses, our sins, onto himself, and to take those illnesses of our loved ones as well, to bear them away. He's the only one that can. Isn't it interesting that this paragraph sits where it does in Matthew 8, with all of these stories surrounding this. Chapter 9 is going to be the same kind of thing. When we get to chapter 9, there's going to be four more stories of miracles and resurrections, and we're going to also see a section where he says, I want you to follow me. He'll say that to Matthew himself. And so I think all of these stories are hemming in these calls to people to come to his side forever. These stories are saying, here's why you should. Here's what he can do. He has true power to change and to forgive and to use you in ways that nobody else can do. And taken all together, these stories ought to conquer your spirit. I'm thankful for all of you who are here today. I don't know if some of you maybe are here because it is Easter Sunday. And in the culture that we live in, many people attend church services on this day because of its significance. It is a wonderful thing that Jesus rose from the dead. I want to encourage you, though, to not just be interested in Jesus on this day of the year, but to follow him with the course of your entire year and your entire life, to sign on to his cause as Matthew encourages you to do. Will you have the faith of the centurion who said, I believe that you can do things with just a word, or do you have the lack of faith of the disciples in the boat who panicked in terror and didn't realize who was actually in the craft with them? All of us have a choice to make. All of us are confronted by this Lord. Not in person, not yet, but through the power of his words. He can change us too. Please let him do that. And if we can help you at all this morning to give up everything to follow Jesus, we would love to know how we can do that for you. So please let us know as together we stand up, we sing the invitation song.